In the quaint English village of Great Rollright in 1945, locals knew little about the elegant woman they called Mrs. Burton, who spoke with a slight accent and baked excellent cakes. None suspected she was Colonel Ursula Kuczynskia of the Red Army, a dedicated communist spy who had conducted espionage across China, Poland, and Switzerland before settling in Britain. Behind her facade of village life, she had built a powerful radio transmitter in her outdoor privy and ran a network of communist spies inside Britain's atomic weapons research program. Her intelligence enabled the Soviet Union to build its own nuclear bomb, forever changing the course of the Cold War. The remarkable story of Agent Sonia, simultaneously a mother, housewife, novelist, radio technician, spymaster, saboteur, and secret agent, has captivated intelligence historians and was described by Vladimir Putin as the work of a super agent of military intelligence. Her life spanned the entire communist era, from the Bolshevik Revolution to the fall of the Berlin Wall, making her perhaps the most consequential female spy in history. On May 1, 1924, 16-year-old Ursula Kuczynskovsky experienced a political awakening when a Berlin policeman struck her during a communist May Day parade. Despite her privileged upbringing in an intellectual Jewish family, this moment crystallized her commitment to fighting social injustice. If young people could be exploited, she declared, they could also fight exploitation. Ursula's childhood had been shaped by contrasting influences. Her beloved nanny, Olga Olomuth, an orphan raised in a brutal Prussian military orphanage, provided the emotional stability her intellectual mother, Berta, lacked. Growing up in Germany's chaotic post-war years, Ursula witnessed extreme inequality and hyperinflation that devastated middle-class families while the wealthy remained untouched. Though denied university education by her mother, she joined the Young Communist League at 16, driven by her father's progressive values and her own observations of social injustice. The May Day beating only strengthened her resolve. She soon joined the KPD, Europe's largest communist party, even learning to shoot in preparation for what she believed would be an inevitable revolution. Her political commitment was absolute, yet her heart remained open to love. At 19, while attending a Marxist workers' class, she met Rudolf Homburger, a Jewish architecture student from a similar background. Their relationship blossomed despite one fundamental difference. Rudy wasn't communist. She longed for his political conversion, while he remained stubbornly liberal. After a brief American adventure where Ursula worked various jobs and joined the American Communist Party, she returned to Germany and married Rudy. They lived in poverty while she established a Marxist lending library. When Rudy received an architecture job offer from Shanghai in 1930, they departed, with Ursula naively believing she could continue her communist activities in China, completely unaware of the political danger awaiting them in a city where communists were routinely tortured and executed. Pregnant and restless in Shanghai's stifling heat, Ursula found work as a secretary at a news agency. Her life changed dramatically when she discovered that Agnes Smedley, an American writer whose feminist novel had deeply impressed her, was living in the city. Their first meeting at the luxurious Cathay Hotel marked the beginning of Ursula's entry into the shadowy world of Soviet espionage. The two women immediately connected, both carrying red roses to mark the anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution. Smedley was striking and distinctive, with short-cropped hair, masculine clothing, and penetrating gray-green eyes. For the first time since arriving in Shanghai, Ursula could speak freely about her political views and frustrations with expatriate life. Through Smedley, Ursula entered a hidden world of Chinese communists and revolutionary writers, attending secret gatherings of the banned League of Left-Wing Writers. What Ursula didn't know was that Agnes was a Soviet spy, working for both the Comintern and military intelligence. 3 weeks after their first meeting, Smedley arranged for Richard Sorg, the most senior Soviet spy in Shanghai, to visit Ursula. With his pronounced limp, missing fingers, and intense blue eyes, Sorg radiated charm and danger. Born to a German father and Russian mother, he had been transformed into a die-hard communist by his traumatic WW1 experiences. Now working for Soviet military intelligence, he combined disciplined espionage with a dissolute personal life marked by womanizing and heavy drinking. In November 1930, Sorg visited Ursula at home, asking if she would support the Chinese communists by providing her apartment as a safe house for revolutionary meetings. Days later, after witnessing police brutality against protesters on Nanking Road, she committed fully to the cause. Unknown to her, Gerhard Eisler, a senior German communist known as the Executioner, observed her that day and approved her recruitment. A pattern of clandestine meetings was established in Ursula's home while Rudy was away at work. Though she knew Sorg was a Soviet spy, she didn't grasp the true nature of Stalin's regime, believing their work advanced both communism and human liberation. Meanwhile, Rudy remained completely unaware of his wife's espionage activities, happily immersed in his architectural work and expatriate life. In April 1931, Ursula and Rudy moved to a spacious villa at 1464 Avenue Joffre in Shanghai's French Concession. While Rudy believed they were simply establishing a proper home for their growing family, Ursula had selected the house specifically for espionage activities. Its garden provided visibility of approaching visitors, and the servants' quarters were conveniently separated from the main house. That summer, Sorg invited Ursula for a motorcycle ride on his powerful Zündapp K500. Racing through the Chinese countryside at breakneck speed with her arms wrapped around him, Ursula experienced a liberating transformation. "I was no longer afraid," she later wrote. This exhilarating ride marked a turning point in their relationship. They soon became lovers. Her role shifted from peripheral safe house keeper to trusted lieutenant in Sorge's spy network. Ursula quickly bonded with other operatives, particularly Irene Isa Wiedemeyer, a red-haired German-Jewish communist who ran the Zeitgeist bookshop, actually a Comintern-funded front serving as a dead-drop site for Soviet intelligence. Sorge began using Ursula as a courier between members of his network and had her type up his handwritten intelligence reports, sometimes hundreds of pages long, which were then sent to Moscow on Soviet ships. Her double life grew increasingly complex as she juggled her roles as spy, mother, and wife. At dinner parties, she gathered information from German businessmen, journalists, and officials while exchanging knowing glances with Sorge across the table. It was Sorge who gave her the code name Sonya, meaning both dormouse, a sleeper agent, and, coincidentally, the name used by Russian prostitutes in Shanghai. The psychological strain was immense as she compartmentalized her competing loyalties to husband, lover, child, and ideology. "Underground work cut deeply into my personal life," she wrote. Meanwhile, Rudolf remained trusting but not oblivious as his wife spent increasing time with her left-wing friends and the good-looking German journalist with the English name. In late June 1931, disaster struck when the Shanghai Municipal Police arrested two key Soviet operatives and discovered encrypted documents revealing an encyclopedia of Soviet espionage in Shanghai. Stalin ordered the Comintern to close all its extensive Shanghai operations and evacuate its staff immediately. As Soviet agents fled the city, Ursula waited by the telephone, ready to escape with her baby at a moment's notice, feeling both terrified and exhilarated. Facing death, she had never felt more intensely alive. By 1933, Ursula had proven her value to Soviet intelligence. Summoned to Moscow for formal training, she faced an agonizing choice: leave her 3-year-old son Michael behind or decline the opportunity. She chose her ideological vocation, delivering Michael to his paternal grandparents in Czechoslovakia before departing while he slept, his pleas of "Mummy, stay with Misha" haunting her journey. In Moscow, Ursula thrived at the Sparrow Spy School, gaining weight and health while mastering espionage techniques. Though tormented by separation from Michael, her commitment never wavered. After 7 months of training, she was assigned to Japanese-occupied Manchuria with a new partner, Johan Patra, a 34-year-old Lithuanian sailor who spoke several languages but struggled with reading. Their relationship would evolve from professional to romantic during their journey back to China. In Mukden, now Shenyang, they established a bookstore as cover while smuggling radio components across the Japanese border. Despite being under surveillance, they successfully built a transmitter and made contact with Chinese communist partisans fighting Japanese occupation. Ursula purchased bomb-making materials, wheeling ammonium nitrate home in Michael's baby carriage, while training local operatives as backup radio operators. The family lived a bizarre triple life: domestic routines with Michael, social engagements with German expatriates, and coordinating communist sabotage operations. Despite the constant danger, Ursula and Johan shared a complicated love alongside their revolutionary work. Occasionally, Rudy would visit from Shanghai, bringing presents for Michael and radio parts, completely unaware of his wife's true activities. When one of their Chinese agents was arrested, Moscow ordered them to abandon the mission. Ursula and Johan buried the radio parts in the forest and relocated to Peking, Beijing. There, Moscow granted them an unexpected 4-week leave, during which they enjoyed a blissful honeymoon exploring the city with Michael. When orders finally came, they were devastating. Ursula was to return to Moscow while Johan would remain in China. She departed without telling him she was pregnant with his child. In Moscow, Colonel Tamanian proposed sending Ursula and Rudy to Poland as a spy team. Rudy, now committed to Soviet intelligence, had agreed to maintain their marriage publicly despite knowing about her pregnancy with Johann's child. Despite her reservations about Rudy's suitability for espionage work, she accepted the assignment. In Poland, the Hamburgers settled in Warsaw, where Ursula built her first solo transmitter hidden in a gramophone case. Her work involved collecting intelligence from an established network, while Rudy found architectural work but was frustrated by Moscow's reluctance to give him real intelligence responsibilities. In April 1936, Ursula gave birth to Nina, transmitting to Moscow just hours after delivery. Later assigned to Nazi-controlled Danzig, Ursula supported a communist resistance cell while raising her children. There, she received the prestigious Order of the Red Banner for her courage, but had to flee when a Nazi neighbor noticed radio interference. Back in Warsaw, Colonel Tamanian offered her advanced training in Moscow when she confessed her frustrations with both her work and marriage situation. By 1938, Ursula requested a new assignment and was sent to Switzerland, a neutral country ideal for espionage. Promoted to major, she was tasked with establishing a radio link to Moscow and recruiting agents to infiltrate Germany. Before leaving, she suggested finding British recruits in London to send into Germany as spies. With her marriage to Rudy finally over, she arrived in Britain in June 1938, joining her family in Hampstead. Through connections in the International Brigade, she was introduced to Alexander Foote, a restless Yorkshire man who had fought in Spain. Though Ursula had already left for Britain by the time Foote arrived, her sister Brigitte arranged his recruitment, instructing him to meet Ursula in Geneva. In Switzerland, Ursula found refuge in a farmhouse called La Tapiniere, the molehill, near Lake Geneva. In this idyllic setting, with magnificent mountain views, she built a radio transmitter hidden in her wardrobe, successfully establishing contact with Moscow on September 29, 1938, the same night Chamberlain signed the Munich Agreement with Hitler. In January 1939, Len Burton, a fearless 25-year-old English veteran of the Spanish Civil War, met Ursula in Vevey, Switzerland. Orphaned young and raised without affection by a foster family, Len had found purpose in radical politics and fighting fascism in Spain. Remarkably, devoid of physical fear, he had survived direct artillery hits without anxiety. Ursula was immediately struck by his appearance: thick brown hair, eyebrows that met, and clear hazel eyes, and his combination of boyish immaturity and sensitivity. For Len, the meeting was transformative. He fell instantly in love with Ursula. That spring, Ursula's agents devised plans to assassinate Hitler. They considered bombing his regular restaurant, the Osteria Bavaria, by placing explosives in an attaché case among the coats, or shooting him directly in a suicidal attack. While Ursula and Bjerten shared the conviction that killing Hitler was morally imperative, Foote was considerably less enthusiastic about dying for the cause. The Nazi-Soviet Pact of August 1939 shattered Ursula's political universe, but practical concerns soon dominated her life in Switzerland. With her German passport expiring and facing statelessness, she initially asked Alexander Foote to marry her to gain British citizenship. When Foote backed out, citing a complicated past in England, Len Bjerten stepped forward. What began as a purely practical arrangement, a paper marriage on February 23, 1940, symbolically the Red Army's founding anniversary, gradually transformed into genuine affection. Despite their age difference and his subordinate position in the spy network, Len's fearlessness, stability, and growing bond with her children touched Ursula deeply. Their relationship evolved naturally, with Ursula later admitting in a letter to her mother, "I love him." Meanwhile, MI5 grew increasingly suspicious of the entire Kuczynski family in Britain, with Ursula's brother Jürgen briefly interned as a Category A threat. Though MI5 attempted to block Ursula's passport application, they acted too late. She received her British citizenship just as Hitler's forces began overrunning Western Europe, leaving Switzerland dangerously encircled by fascist powers. In June 1940, following France's fall, Moscow instructed Ursula to contact Alexander Sándor Rado, a Hungarian Jewish communist cartographer running the Rote-Dry spy network, a crucial component of the wider Red Orchestra anti-Nazi intelligence operation. Ursula retrieved her radio from its woodland hiding place and established an elaborate system of dead drops and chalk signals to facilitate communication. After an increasingly precarious existence in Switzerland, Ursula arranged for her children to be placed in boarding school and prepared to move operations to Geneva. However, Moscow ordered her to leave Switzerland immediately as her network had been compromised. After transferring her responsibilities to Foote, Ursula prepared to travel to Britain with her children, though Len was denied a Spanish transit visa and forced to remain behind. MI5 immediately flagged her arrival as suspicious, placing her on their blacklist before she even reached British shores. After a harrowing 3-week journey aboard the SS Avicheda, Ursula and her children arrived in Liverpool, where she was immediately questioned by British intelligence before being allowed to continue to Oxford. Moscow had arranged a rendezvous point for Ursula in London's Red Light District, where she was to meet a Soviet military intelligence officer. For 3 months, she faithfully traveled from Oxford to Shepherd Market every fortnight, waiting uncomfortably among prostitutes who grew suspicious of her presence, but her contact never appeared. By April 1941, with her savings nearly depleted, Ursula finally found a bungalow to rent in Kidlington. In late May, her persistence paid off when she was approached by Nikolai Vladimirovich Aptekar, codename Iris, a Soviet military intelligence officer working under diplomatic cover. After exchanging code words, they met briefly in a shop doorway where he provided funds and instructions to establish a new information network. On June 22, 1941, Hitler launched Operation Barbarossa against the Soviet Union. The attack transformed the conflict, making Britain and the Soviet Union allies. Ursula was simultaneously devastated by the assault on communism and relieved that her espionage work could once again focus on defeating Nazism. With Moscow hungry for intelligence about Britain's true intentions, Ursula recruited her father, Robert Kuczynski, who had connections to left-wing economists and labor politicians involved in the war effort. Her network expanded to include other left-wing intellectuals with access to valuable information. The most significant addition to her network came through her brother Jürgen, the brilliant German physicist Klaus Fuchs, who had been recruited to work on Britain's top-secret atomic weapons program, codenamed Tube Alloys. Despite knowing Fuchs's communist background, MI5 had granted him security clearance, desperately needing his rare brilliance in theoretical physics. When Hitler invaded the Soviet Union, Fuchs felt morally obligated to share atomic secrets with Moscow, believing the weapons should be available to the big powers equally. In late summer 1942, Ursula met Fuchs at a cafe opposite Birmingham's Snow Hill Station, beginning their critical espionage relationship. During this first meeting, Fuchs handed over 85 pages of documents containing the latest reports from Britain's atomic project, the most dangerous secret in the world. Finding Birmingham Station too public, Ursula selected the unremarkable market town of Banbury as their meeting place. For the next year, she and Fuchs met every few weeks in the countryside, with Ursula leaving written instructions in a dead letterbox about meeting times and locations. Their walks never exceeded half an hour and never followed the same route twice. Fuchs's transfer of scientific secrets to the Soviet Union between 1941 and 1943 yielded an extraordinary 570 pages of copied reports, calculations, drawings, and diagrams, essentially a step-by-step guide to atomic weapon development. Through Fuchs and Ursula, Moscow received virtually all scientific data from Britain's Tube Alloys project, prompting Soviet leadership to codename the nuclear weapons project Enormos. By April 1942, Stalin had ordered the Soviet Union to commence its own atomic program, with scientists working from the foundation of Fuchs's stolen secrets. Beyond Fuchs, Ursula's network expanded to include at least a dozen spies. Melita Norwood copied documents from the British Non-Ferrous Metals Research Association, the Kuczynski brothers collected information, and an RAF officer provided aircraft development details, including Lancaster bomber trigger mechanisms. By late 1942, Ursula transmitted to Moscow two or three times weekly, often working through the night. In spring 1943, with her spy network running at full capacity, 36-year-old Ursula discovered she was pregnant. Despite the challenges of managing three children alongside espionage work, Ursula insisted on continuing, seeing Russian victory at Stalingrad as cause for celebration and recognizing that infants provided good legalization. The more children she had, the less suspicious she appeared. Around this time, Ursula was secretly promoted to colonel in Soviet military intelligence, the only woman to achieve such rank, though Moscow never informed her of this promotion. In Britain, Mrs. Burton cultivated the perfect cover as an ordinary housewife in Oxford, cycling around town, caring for her children, and growing vegetables. Her domestic camouflage proved extraordinarily effective against male-dominated intelligence services. However, one formidable woman at MI5 had begun tracking her movements. Millicent Baggett was the sort of Englishwoman who struck fear into foreigners and colleagues alike, unmarried, austere, and formidably intelligent. As one of the few women in MI5 and the first to reach senior rank, she was renowned for her encyclopedic knowledge of communism. Baggett had been tracking the Kuczynski family from their arrival in Britain, opposing Jurgen's release from internment and identifying him as one of Moscow's most brilliant and dangerous propagandists. In late June 1944, Ursula received an urgent summons from her brother Jurgen. Meeting on Hampstead Heath, he explained that a young American intelligence officer had approached him seeking help to recruit German exiles willing to parachute into Nazi Germany as spies. Lieutenant Joseph Gold, a 29-year-old former publicist for the motion picture industry, had been dispatched to Britain on this specific mission. The Americans had created Operation Faust, a plan to parachute trained German exiles back into Germany to connect with underground labor movements and gather vital intelligence. Ursula immediately saw an opportunity to infiltrate American intelligence by providing recruits who would serve as double agents for Moscow. Ursula compiled a list of 30 reliable German communists in Britain, seeking Moscow's approval for each candidate. She appointed Erich Henschke, using the alias Karl Castro, as her cutout to maintain operational security. Gold selected 7 volunteers, organizing them into 5 missions codenamed Hammer, Chisel, Pickaxe, Mallet, and Buzzsaw, collectively known as the Tool Missions. The German recruits underwent intensive preparation, parachute training, weapons and combat instruction, and immersion in German prisoner of war camps to reacquaint themselves with current conditions in the Reich. Most critically, they learned to use the revolutionary Joan Eleanor communication system, a prototype VHF radio allowing direct voice communication between ground agents and aircraft flying overhead. Through Henschke, each German volunteer was secretly sworn in as a GRU agent, instructed to report everything they learned about American methods, equipment, and operations. Ursula transmitted all details to Moscow, which was particularly interested in the Joan Eleanor system, technology the Soviets didn't possess. On March 1, 1945, the Operation Hammer agents departed from RAF Watten in Norfolk. The spies parachuted into Germany near Alt-Friesach, landing safely in a field before making their way to Berlin. There, they began collecting vital intelligence on bomb damage, defenses, ammunition storage, troop deployments, and Germany's industrial resilience. Over the next 6 weeks, the Hammer agents reported crucial intelligence on Berlin's defenses, transportation networks, and industrial targets. Following Ursula's instructions, they made contact with Soviet forces using her password and were likely debriefed by Soviet intelligence before being handed back to American forces. The fall of Berlin brought unconstrained joy throughout Britain, including to Ursula in Avenue Cottage, Oxford. She had coordinated the Hammer mission, helping steer American walkie-talkie technology into Soviet hands while also contributing to Berlin's liberation from Nazism. As the war ended, Ursula's role shifted. Having spied against fascists before and during the war, she would now spy against the West in the emerging Cold War. A week after V-Day, Ursula and her children moved to The Firs, a honey-colored Cotswold stone house in Great Rollright, a picturesque hamlet with 243 residents. Despite lacking electricity, telephone, and hot water, the 250-year-old house with its thick wooden beams became their first real home. The large locked cellar proved ideal for concealing radio equipment. In Great Rollright, Ursula's espionage network operated smoothly. Melita Norwood continued providing secrets from the British Non-Ferrous Metals Association, while her brother Jürgen prepared to return to East Berlin. Her transmitter was in constant use, though her children noticed her unusual afternoon naps. But in autumn 1946, Ursula's contact with Moscow abruptly ceased when a GRU officer failed to appear for a rendezvous. Following protocol, she checked their dead drop site, a hollow tree root, but found nothing for months. Unknown to her, the GRU had mistakenly been leaving messages under the wrong tree, creating mutual confusion. When the United States dropped atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in August 1945, the Cold War began in earnest. Through Klaus Fuchs and Harry Gold, Moscow had received complete details of both atomic and hydrogen bomb research. In August 1949, the Soviets successfully tested their first atomic bomb, a virtual copy of the American design thanks to spies like Fuchs. On February 3, 1950, Ursula read the headline, "German Atomic Scientist Arrested. Klaus Fuchs had been caught." When Ursula saw the newspaper mentioning a foreign woman with black hair in Banbury, she felt pure fear. Though Fuchs hadn't yet revealed her name, she knew it was only a matter of time before MI5 made the connection. With his trial scheduled for February 28th, Ursula acted swiftly. She applied for a German visa, telling her younger children they were going on holiday. She burned incriminating papers in the yard, buried her radio transmitter in the woods, and left one last message at her dead drop site explaining her defection to Berlin. On February 27, 1950, Ursula and her children flew from London. She sat rigidly in the departure lounge, expecting at any moment to see security officers burst in to arrest her. But the moment never came. As the plane took off, she left England behind, not to return for 40 years. Ursula returned to a war-ravaged East Berlin in February 1950, finding herself in a cold one-room apartment with her children who missed their life in Great Rollright. While the children struggled to adjust at school, Ursula experienced an unfamiliar sensation, peace. For the first time in 20 years, she wasn't being stalked, had no radio transmitter to hide, no agents to contact. After months of isolation, a GRU officer finally contacted her in May, offering her new intelligence work. To his shock, Ursula announced her decision to quit spying altogether. "I wanted to live as a citizen. My nerves and powers of concentration were no longer as good as they had been. I felt that 20 years were enough." Remarkably, despite the GRU's reputation for not allowing resignations, the center let her go without reprisal. In 1956, Ursula reinvented herself once more, becoming Ruth Werner, novelist. She wrote 14 books, mostly stories for children and young adults that were thinly disguised autobiographies of her adventures. These bestsellers allowed her to circumvent East German censors while satisfying her compulsion to dramatize her extraordinary life. Meanwhile, the Stasi kept her under constant surveillance, noting her individualist attitude, despite acknowledging her 20 years of confidential work for the party. When Khrushchev revealed Stalin's crimes in 1956, Ursula was appalled, suffering survivor's guilt over friends lost in the purges. Ursula's children achieved success. Michael became a leading Shakespeare scholar, Nina a teacher, and Peter a distinguished biologist philosopher, but carried the psychological burden of their extraordinary childhood. For Michael particularly, the scars ran deep. Having lived in 6 different countries by age 10 and discovering his family life was built on secrets, Michael struggled with trust throughout his life. Ursula outlived all her lovers. Len Buerten died in 1997 at 83. Rudolf Hamburger died in Dresden in 1980, after enduring 10 years in the Soviet Gulag system. Though she have loved Rudy for his kindness, Patra for his revolutionary strength, and Len for his comradeship, Richard Sorg remained the love of her life. His framed photograph hung on her study wall until she died. The communist regime showered Ursula with honors. In 1977, she published her autobiography, Sonia's Report, an instant bestseller that revealed her espionage career to her astonished children. Though written under Stasi control, she refused to remove sections about her unconventional love life. When the Berlin Wall fell in 1989, the 82-year-old Ursula addressed a rally predicting reformed communism. But German reunification left her with a certain hopelessness which I never had before. She died on July 7, 2000, at age 93. Weeks later, Vladimir Putin awarded her the Order of Friendship, proclaiming her a super-agent of military intelligence. Though not a feminist, Ursula excelled in a male-dominated profession. Her communism wasn't intellectual fashion, but born from witnessing the savage inequalities of Weimar and the horrors of Nazism. Risk-addicted, tough, and warm, she inspired enduring loyalty. Her life spanned the entire communist era, from the Bolshevik Revolution to the fall of the Berlin Wall. She fought for what she believed right, only to see much of it proven wrong. Yet she remained proud of fighting Nazism, loving well, raising a family, and helping ensure nuclear parity between superpowers. Even in old age, her nightmares revealed her true identity. "The enemy is at my heels, and I have no time to destroy the information."